Jose Villegas is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Jose Villegas to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Pat Hartwell, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood. Tonight's featured guest is the condemned man himself, Jose Villegas, who recently taped an interview with the show. The execution watch for Jose Villegas begins.
Good evening. It is April the 16th, 2014. At 6 p.m., Texas is fixing to kill Jose Villegas. My name is Ray Hill. I'm the host of Execution Watch. Elizabeth Stein is in touch with the Supreme Court of the United States, and we have witnesses, reporters in Huntsville to tell us what's happening. At last resort, before we walked in the studio, the Supreme Court was still scratching their head about this case, but it seems almost a foregone conclusion. This case is going to proceed. Therefore, we are in the studio. Do we have a report from Huntsville? All right. So you're on the air. Come on.
Hello, Ray. How are you tonight?
Hi, Pat. What's going on up there?
Well, as usual, it's another somber moment for us and a disgraceful moment for the state of Texas. This is the 515th person that has been executed and 276 for Rick Perry's belt. The 17 executions have occurred in the U.S. this year, and Texas has 7 of them, so that's nearly half of them. We're here tonight from the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement, along with people from the community, from Huntsville of the faith community, and several different organizations are being represented here tonight to protest this horrible, horrible thing that the state of Texas is doing. As always, we want to give a shout-out to the guys on the row. We are terribly sorry, and our thoughts are always with y'all when something like this happens. So please, guys, keep your heads up and your spirits high. There are people out here that have your back at all times. The family has not come by, has not crossed the street yet. So
what about the media? Has the media gone? Pat?
Yes.
Has the media crossed?
No, nobody has crossed yet, and it's 6 o'clock. We're waiting, so I'm sure they're going to cross at any moment because I understand that the Supreme Court has given a negative ruling. If they've ruled at all, I think they probably refused to hear it, didn't they?
Well, the issue is not whether or not they hear it. They were going to take time to hear it. They would give it a stay until they took time. So the issue is that it goes. The way that happens, whenever someone's being executed in Texas, it goes to Justice Scalia through the Capitol Court, Capitol Case Court Clerk, and he makes a determination of whether or not he should independently make that decision or whether he should share it with other justices, I presume on the recommendation of that clerk. And then once that is done, if it is necessary for more judges to consider the case, then they would delay
that. Yeah, well, we understand that. You know, the lower courts ruled against Mr. Villegas. He tried to file a Martinez claim in his appeal, and they said that he could not file a Martinez claim. They denied him, and we all know that a Martinez claim is a lousy lawyer. The lawyers in his trial did not bring up his mental health issues, and the appeals, from what I understand, years ago when he was first doing his appeals, said that he could not file the Martinez claim because, number one, the lawyers got up in court and said, yeah, we did the best we could. And then he could not file a mental health claim
because we're going to get into the strategy or lack thereof by the lawyers. That'll come in later in the show. You keep your eye out for crossing witnesses and let us know as soon as something happens.
I sure will. Just call me back.
Okay. Well, call us back if you can.
I sure will. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And we have, I guess, line two is on the air. Hello. Hello. Who's there?
This is Dave Atwood.
Right? Hey, Dave, where is there?
We're at the corner of Benz and Main, right across from the Museum of Fine Arts.
Oh.
And we've got about 9 people out here today. We've got 10 people now.
Okay.
So pretty good turnout. Telemundo has taken some pictures and apparently going to do some interviews. It's a good... Like I've said before, we've got a good group of people here, and we're protesting this death penalty and this execution, just like we have other ones.
Well, there seems to be a little hitch in the come along. I just go through talking to Pat in Huntsville, and she informs me that neither the media witnesses nor the family witnesses have crossed the road.
Okay.
So I'm looking at this case as objectively as I can. I never look at these cases objectively, especially after I've interviewed the person being executed, but as objectively as I can, it doesn't seem to be much chance for a durable stay, but sometimes getting the paperwork out of the Supreme Court's just delayed.
Yeah.
How do people get in touch with your organization, Dave?
The best way is to go to our website, which is TCADP.org. That's our state website, but they can get linked into the people in Houston through that website, and then get our information and our execution vigil schedule and all of that sort of information. So that's the best way, is through the website.
Okay, give our regards to the vigilance there.
Yeah, we got a good group of people here, right?
And tell them we thank them for their commitment to the cause, and we'll talk to you later, Dave.
Okay, thank you. You take care.
Bye-bye. Jim, you said this wasn't one of them high pay-per-use cases.
This is the most unusual case in the sense every opinion I read literally had nothing about the facts. It's kind of like he did the crime, they gave him the death penalty, and tough luck. That's about what the courts have said.
Any speculation on why we haven't gotten final word on death penalty from the Supreme Court?
That would be a wild guess. I have no idea.
You expect it to happen,
though. Of course. I think it will.
I think it'll happen. Okay. Tell us, what is this case?
Well, what happened, Jose Villegas had been dating a young lady, a 24-year-old woman named Rita Salazar, and Rita's mother opposed them dating and was pretty mad about it, and so he was angry. He went to their house one day, killed the mother, stabbed her something like 35 times. Then he turned around and attacked his girlfriend, stabbed her to death, stabbed her a number of times, and Rita had a 3-year-old baby, stabbed the baby to death. So he stabbed 3 people to death, and then after he stabbed them to death, he then stole a television set and stole the mother's car and left in the car. Well, neighbors saw him fleeing from the house because it's during the day. And what happened when the father came home, and Rita's father came home from jury service of all things, he finds all 3 bodies. And then, of course, the neighbors had seen Villegas leaving the house in the car, and they immediately put a lookout for the car. Well, in the interim, what Villegas had done, he had pawned the television set and bought some cocaine. And the police saw him in the car. When they tried to stop him, there was a short police chase. He bailed out of the car, and they caught him. And what happened after they caught him, he then confessed to it. So the evidence is pretty conclusive because they had, number one, his DNA on the blood. They had him stealing items stolen from the house, had him in the stolen car, plus he had a confession. And the trial lawyer who tried this case, you remember Luther Jones down in Corpus? He was Percy's right-hand man? Well, his son was the one that tried this case. It's Grant Jones. And so at least from pedigree, there's some pedigree, I don't, because Luther had been Percy's right-hand person, if you recall correctly. And he's the one that tried the case. And as he said, this case was never a question about guilt. It's always a question about punishment.
What jurisdiction did this happen in?
It happened in Corpus Christi, Nueces County. Was a native of Nueces County. I tried to find out. But this case is unusual. There's very little published on the opinions. I mean, they're just...
Did he have much of a prior record?
No, he'd never been to prison before. Susan's going to discuss. He had some prior unadjudicated
offenses. Oh, Susan's going to get around to punishment.
Yes, she's, and then... I thought one of the most interesting things, and I've asked Mike to discuss this, is the trial itself was one of the most unusual capital cases I'd ever read. Mike and I have been discussing it this week.
All right, Mike, this case flies over your transom, and you're responsible for trying it. What's it going to be like?
Well, as Jim
said... Get closer to the microphone.
As Jim stated, you have a witness who saw him leave the house. You have a confession. You have stolen goods that he was found with the proceeds of the sale. He ran from the police, he was caught with drugs, and his DNA evidence. The lawyer acknowledged that he was guilty. I do not understand how a lawyer acknowledges that, but he did. The end result of this case was a question of punishment. What the lawyer tried to use as punishment is something called intermediate explosive disorder. He brought in a psychologist into the courtroom to try to explain that this man had a problem with instant rage. The problem with that is that doesn't necessarily help you with a jury with this kind of violent crimes to show that the person had a rage problem. Besides that man coming in testifying to rage, I don't see any defense put on in this case. So it seemed like the only defense was saying should not be killed because this instant rage, the problem with that makes him very scary to deal with. So that was basically it from trial.
Michael, let me kind of interrupt a second. Let me tell you one of the reasons the lawyer may do what you just described. If you know the only issue is going to be punishment, you want to have some credibility with the jury. And if there's no question about guilt, and you get up and try to argue some stupid argument, you're going to offend the jury, and you're going to lose your credibility as a lawyer. So when you come down to punishment, you want to have some credibility left. And if a case is, I've done that before, I've told juries, I picked a murder case one time, there's no question about guilt. I told the jury ahead of time, if I was on the jury, I'd find him guilty.
Well,
and you do that because you know your issue is going to be punishment, and you want to walk in with some credibility with the jury.
Well, then the question becomes, when he is arraigned in front of the jury and he pleads not guilty or guilty, if you want to get that purpose to the jury, get up at guilt or innocent and acknowledge that I'm guilty, go right to punishment. Maybe that can help you more with the jury where
you
admit your
crime. Well, the problem with that is you waive all error of entering a plea of guilty. That's what you explain to a jury in voir dire. We have to do certain legal things. One of them is plead not guilty for appellate purposes. Explain that.
Well, this rage defense, which is not presented until Susan starts talking about the punishment, right?
No, they brought this up at trial.
They brought it up at trial.
That was the defense in an
okay, so the trial. Is there such a thing as temporary loss of control that keeps one from being culpable?
I don't believe so. I think the question is future dangerousness. And
it's not in the manual somewhere that you can...
Not that I'm aware of.
What they, if you're talking about temporary insanity, basically, is what you're talking about. Usually that comes in when you have, and this is one of the things, strange things about capital murder. Basically, we have a system where if you're found guilty of murder and then at a punishment hearing, if they find that you were enraged because of adequate cause and you killed somebody during that rage, and the thing that made you enraged would enrage any normal person. For example, I come home, someone's burning my house and laughing at me. I just blow up and kill him.
Okay.
And I'm not working in my right state because I'm enraged by conduct that would enrage anybody. In that situation, the case is the verdict is a 2-20. They don't get you can't give them it's a murder case, but the punishment range is 2-20. The problem is with the capital murder case, I've never seen that submitted. It's a punishment issue, and I've never seen that submitted at a punishment phase. To answer your question, there is that, but all it does is reduce the murder range from 5 to life to 2-20. That's the only difference.
The next interesting thing that came up during the appeal, they complained about the way the lawyer picked the jury. And let's talk about juries for a second. In a normal trial, they bring all the juries in the courtroom. They all sit in the courtroom, and both lawyers have a chance to question them, talk to them, observe their body movements, observe the way they pay attention. And at the end of the day, they get to strike the ones they do not want.
Yeah.
Kaplan murder trials are not handled like that because of the extensive questioning of each witness. Each witness can take 45 minutes to an hour to do.
And each juror can
each
take...
Juror, excuse okay. me, each juror takes 45 minutes to an hour to do, and the reason they do it like that is to give that juror a chance to have a conversation with both attorneys, open up on some personal issues, get the lawyer a better chance to get a feel for the juror, and they take their time and talk to them to make a very important decision. But when it takes 45 minutes to an hour apiece, you can only do about 8 a day. When you have 40, 50 people, you can't have everybody waiting around in the courtroom. So they do it one at a time, 8 a day, until they pick the ones they want. The next problem with that is that with a normal jury panel of a room full of people, you have 15 strikes, which means that after you talk to all the jurors and find out who you like, who you don't like,
yeah.
you can start listing the ones you do not like more than the others and start striking them as you see fit, knowing your entire panel. The disadvantage of the way that this was done, when it's done individually, you're striking each juror one at a time, and you don't know what's coming the next day. And if you end up striking too many people, you might have people on the next day that you wish you had a strike left and you don't have them because you struck it too early. So these are the issues that were brought up in the appellate court as to how the lawyer did not handle the case properly. The problem is that the standard to reverse a lawyer's strategy at the appellate level is a very difficult standard. The appellate court is not going to reverse what an attorney does on a trial strategy, thinking that he knows best what's best for his client. In order to get it reversed,
they just defer to that lawyer on that.
Unless there's some evidence goes on the stand that he didn't, that it was not a strategy, that he did something that was not right.
Like go to sleep or something.
But the lawyer would have to come in court and say something of that nature. In this case, the lawyer didn't. So when the appellate court reached that question, they had nothing to review. And with nothing to review, the presumption is that what the lawyer did was correct. Even mistakes the lawyer made, he made it on purpose at the strategy situation, and there's no allegation of mistakes this lawyer made. But because there was no evidence that the way he picked the jury was wrong, they didn't do anything about it. They even went to the point of saying, for all we know, there was a reason for it. For all we know, there was an agreement to do it like this. We do not know, but the record did not reflect it, and since the record cannot reflect it, we cannot undo it.
So let me do a little housekeeping here. Elizabeth, would you check with Pat and see if the witnesses have crossed the road? And Susan, what happened on punishment?
At the punishment phase of the trial, what the state had to work with was they had some prior convictions. He had prior convictions for terroristic threats, for threatening to kill a few women. So I guess he had a few cases of terroristic threats.
But that didn't get him in prison.
Those were terroristic threats would only be misdemeanors.
Oh, okay.
He never went to prison before. The terroristic threats were misdemeanors. He also had a conviction for burglary. The burglary, he could have been placed on probation. He could have done some county time, but he was not in prison for the burglary.
He did 200 days on county time in probation.
200 days.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But he hadn't gone to prison for the burglary. And he also had a conviction for possession of inhalants, which would be a misdemeanor. Now, there were some unadjudicated offenses that the state could also put on witnesses at trial to testify to other unadjudicated offenses, other bad acts. He was on bond for a sexual assault, so the victim of the sexual assault could be called to testify at the punishment phase. He also had two cases of indecency with a child. Well, excuse me, two counts in a case of indecency with a child. There was also a case where he punched a woman in the face. The woman he punched in the face apparently was related to the victim child on the indecency case. So that's essentially what the state had to work with at punishment. Now, after he was committed and given a death sentence, The state went forward, and they convicted him of the indecency with a child.
Did the defense do anything unusual in the face of all this evidence?
Not that I could tell. They had put on evidence of intermittent explosive disorder at trial.
Is that even in the journal? Is that in the list of...
You mean DSM?
DSM, yeah.
No.
It's not even there?
No.
It's only in the movies. There's a movie.
It's only in Corpus Christi, I hate to tell you. It's not even in
Corpus
the movies.
Christi, yeah.
There's a movie where that type
may
of
may happen in Corpus Christi, and that made the movies, but it doesn't make the court.
Only in Corpus Christi have we heard about this before.
And then he was convicted on the indecency with a child after he got the death sentence.
Oh, okay. So that was not available. The conviction of that was not available at the time of the trial.
Well, but they could have witnesses testify. Oh, okay. I mean, they could bring the mother or the parent.
I think what I'm going to get the audience to do, Mr. Villegas and I had a conversation in the visit room on the Ellis unit. That was videotaped and audio taped, and we have the audio for you today. If you will stay in touch with executionwatch.org and in touch with our Facebook page, we will announce whenever that will be available for your viewing. If you live in Houston, we will announce when it will be broadcast on Channel 17 from Houston Media Source. Doyle, can we have that interview now?
Ray, I spoke with Pat Hartwell, and witnesses have not crossed the street.
So, as far as we know, Mr. Villegas is alive in a holding tank, waiting to be bolted down, and then they will proceed from there.
Now, Ray, what I don't know is he was convicted of possession of inhalants. I don't know if he was a habitual inhalant user, and if that had any effect on the organic makeup of his brain.
Okay. Well, I know. We're going to discuss that after we get through hearing from Mr. Villegas himself. This is Ray Hill with Execution Watch. I'm this Ray Jose Hill. Villegas, and we're at the visiting room on the Polinsky unit, which is where death row folks go to meet the media. Mm-hmm. How are you doing today?
What's that? I'm doing pretty good, man. Pretty good.
You know what this is all about?
Yes.
We have your permission to use both the audio and the radio and the video later.
Right.
Okay. What's on your mind?
Well, not a whole lot. I mean, just, going about my days as usual, you know. I mean, the whole execution, you know, it's obviously coming up, you know.
You've been on the row how long?
I've been on the death row for 12 years.
12 years.
Yeah, and these last couple of days, you know, I've just been writing my letters and getting my visits, getting everything set up, situated for my last...
farewell.
Yeah, my last visits, too.
Pretty heavy trip.
Yeah.
Corpus Christi?
Yes.
Grew up there?
Yes.
Like Corpus Christi?
Yeah, born and raised, yeah.
Nice place.
Yes.
Funny politics, but nice place.
Yeah.
There's always a war going on down Corpus Christi,
yeah.
Politically, ethnically.
Yeah.
Tell me about Jose Villegas in Corpus Christi.
Well, before my arrest, mm-hmm. I was married, you know, got children, and... I was what you would call a recreational drug user, mm-hmm. which became a habit really quick. Of course, when you're doing drugs, you know, other problems tend to appear. So with the whole family thing, you know, and drugs mixing was not a good combination. I worked and did what I needed to do for my family. I love my kids. Very much. I still write to them. They're still in my life. But unfortunately, I was a little bit more in love with the whole drug use, you know. I suffered from depression quite a bit, you know, when my mother passed away. Just dealing with being married so young, having issues at home, you know, that every married couple has. But, you know, at 19 years old, 20 years old, you know, you kind of tend to deal with them in a childish way. So I turned to drugs, and that became my out, you know. And pretty much drug use is what led me to where I am now, you know. It's not something I'm proud of. I don't brag about it. You know, I've encouraged my children throughout the years to stay clear of drug use and try to be the best they can. And thankfully, they're doing good. They're good kids.
What has the last 12 years done to that guy?
Well, man, it's taught me a lot. Definitely, I can say that. It may sound cliche to say I'm a changed person, you know, because everybody comes to prison and says they're a changed person. But I'm definitely a changed person. I'm mature. I'm older now. I was arrested when I was 25 years old. I'll be 39 years old 2 days prior before my execution. So, I mean, it's changed me a lot. It's opened my eyes to a lot of things that were once not even a possibility, you know, things that I can do now as far as control my anger, control my urges for addiction and stuff like that. Because in prison, you know, you can get your hands on stuff if you really try. And I've had the opportunity probably once or twice, and I've never... Because I don't want to do that no more.
You can't get any more trouble. You're on the damn road.
Well, yeah, true. But,
that ain't what's controlling it. What's controlling it is
me. Well, see, you know, just a real quick story. When I was in the county jail waiting trial on this case, I was probably about 6 months into my stay there at the county. I came across some drugs, some cocaine. And this guy, well, he's like, hey, you want to buy it? You know, I'm like, sure, come on with it. So it was just a little bit of dope, and I ended up using it all and paid him with money that people who didn't have it in the world gave it to me so I can buy the things I need.
Yeah.
So basically, I was wasting their money.
Valuable money.
Right. That they gifted to me so that I can be comfortable in jail. And I used it, and I remember sitting back and thinking, man, what the hell did I do? You know? And at that time, I had a picture of my children who were just babies at the time. I mean, they were 5 and younger, you know? And I looked at that picture, and I seen them smiling and being so happy, and it hit me. The guilt just hit me. And I said, man, you know, this has got to be the stupidest thing I've done. I'm in prison. I'm in jail facing capital murder charges. Possibly going to death row, lose my family, my children, and here I am still doing the same old, you know, I've been doing. And it hit me right then and there, and I made a promise at that point that nobody's ever heard. Maybe one or two other people, my best friend here and a couple other friends of mine. But I made a promise that, hey, you know what? No matter what, I'm never going to do drugs again. Never. And I promised my children at that time, and I can honestly say that I've never done it.
I had to leave my AA chip out in the car. I got 55 years of being drug and alcohol free.
Wow.
So I know what you're talking about. Still go to meetings.
Right.
Mostly in prison these days, mm-hmm. But go to meetings. You're on the road.
Yes.
You know a lot of guys.
Yeah.
Talk to them. It's not easy to communicate with them, but you can communicate with them.
Yeah.
Do you think we ever actually execute the person that was involved in the case, ever?
Absolutely not, no. No, I've seen many, many men leave here totally different than when they came in. Of course, I didn't know a lot of them when they came in. Most of them I did. But, you know, every case is different, and every person's different. But there's something about death row that... just really changes a person for the better. And I honestly believe, and there was an officer here who once said that he would hire any one of these guys to work on his farm, to tend to his horses, you know. There's a lot of officers that work general population that come to death row and say, I'd rather work death row. General population is crazy. Those guys are nuts.
Well, the reason you're on the Polunsky was a decision made by Wayne Scott. Now, right. I know Wayne Scott. Mm-hmm. I met Wayne Scott when he was the row sergeant.
Okay.
I worked with Wayne Scott and Billy Hughes to get the work program started on the row so guys could get out of their cell and do something useful with their hands.
Right.
But Garulli's escape had an impression on me.
Yeah, Corpus Christi. From Corpus Christi, yeah. I remember that. It was Thanksgiving. I was at home with my wife and my children, eating turkey. Yeah. When that happened, yeah.
I was in Huntsville.
Yeah.
With Amy Goodman of Democracy Now.
Oh yeah, I know who she is. Yeah.
When Garulli punched it.
Yeah.
And here I was driving up and down the street with a crazy doctor driving an SUV. We stopped about every 100 yards for shakedown.
Yeah.
And she wanted to get out there and find Garulli. And ultimately, when they found him in the river,
right.
She beat the security and got around to him. Mm. She's an amazing journalist.
Yeah.
But that had an effect on Wayne Scott. And Wayne Scott brought about this move to Polunsky. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to him about him several times. And he said, well, what else am I supposed to do? And I said, Wayne, you got to just realize that everybody on the row ain't trying to escape.
No.
Everybody in Raleigh wants to get off the row, but not that way.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you have people with behavioral problems on the row. I mean, it's natural for someone to act up, especially in a solitary confinement type place. But for the most part, and I'm not just saying this, for the most part, you're gonna have a pretty laid back situation if all goes well. You know, I mean, people get upset for their showers and their recreation, and of course, you know, because we got to depend on the officers.
That's all you got.
But for the most part, it's pretty laid back, man. And you know, this is one of the only places in probably the whole system where a person will show up on death row and someone will hand them a goodie bag filled with soaps and toothpaste, yeah, and not expect nothing in return.
It's kind of a welcome group,
right, and not expect anything in return.
Yeah,
you know, someone in population may do that and then try to extort them later, or you know, in some cases try to punk them.
Yeah,
you know, but not here, you know.
Serious business.
Right.
Is it a community? Have you created a community there?
Yeah.
You know, I've been trying to create a community among convicts for 30 years on the prison show.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think it ever worked.
Mm-hmm.
What does it take? Because if we could create a community of inmates,
mm-hmm.
then we can look at the whole criminal justice system mm-hmm. as a united group.
Well, I think with death row, it's the fact that everybody shares the same sentence. Everybody shares the same sentence.
You ain't got no deuces, no nickels, and no dimes.
Nothing. You got nobody going home. You got nobody, you know, making parole or nothing like that. Everybody shares the same sentence. Everybody shares the same grief, the same anger. They all got family that's dealing with the issues, and they're all remorseful. I mean, for the most part, everybody's pretty remorseful, man. You know, there's no difference from a person who killed somebody and that's living out in population than someone here.
Were you on the road when Kerry Max Cook was on the road?
No, I was not, no.
You know who he is?
Yes, I do.
I got emailed from his wife today.
Mm-hmm.
He's in the hospital and said some heart problems. Kerry's very fragile.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I talked to Anthony Graves.
Yeah, I know. I remember him.
A couple of days ago.
Yeah, I remember him. Yeah, I remember. I met him briefly, you know, come across him when he was here, still here. I knew him just on passing.
Is there a difference between the guys who you have reason to believe are truly innocent and the guys that are not?
Is there a difference you're asking?
Yeah, from your perspective on the row, I mean, can you?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, someone who's innocent, and I know a few who, you know,
are
credibly innocent, and they are different in the way that they definitely fight for their appeals. because someone who's guilty and knows they're guilty is probably more than likely going to say, oh, well, okay, you know, I got
you
kicked.
You pay, you play.
And, you know, I kicked out of the Fifth Circuit, you know, okay, well, they're hoping for a life sentence, just getting off the roll. Mm-hmm. The innocent guys are hoping to get home.
Yeah.
And they know it's not as easy. But as far as personality-wise and stuff like that, no, they're just, I mean, I know two guys at least, Swearingen, Larry Swearingen, and another one named Ivan Cantu.
Yeah.
And both of those are really good friends of mine.
Yeah.
And we cut it up all the time.
Sure.
And, you know, they're good guys. They're good guys, but they're innocent, and they're credibly innocent, and I would like to see them go home one day, man.
Tell me what it's like for you on the road when there's actually an execution happening. What?
Well,
if you know the person, I suppose, you know, it's different if you don't know
them. Right, right. But, you know, when I first arrived, executions were happening a lot more than they have now. And I didn't know many people. But as the years went by and I got to know more people, and the executions kept going, you know, I started thinking, well, wow, you know, here is this guy. One day he's here, the next day he's gone. But it's funny because it's back there, it's not necessarily like, oh, well, he's going to go die. Everybody's mourning. People, you know, mourn in their own ways. But it's more like, hey, man, I'll see you later. Shake his hand and tap him on the back and, hey, man, you know, just take it easy. You know, it's kind of like a farewell, but in some way, you know that he's going to be okay.
It's a special kind of grief.
It's a different kind of grief, yeah. I've lost really good friends, and it's sad, and it bums you out. And what keeps you kind of laughing and going is the memories you've made back there with them, you know. It's not, we can't move around a lot. We can't associate, you know, interact with each other.
I mean, but it's not like it. And of course, there's a movement to improve the conditions.
Right, right, right.
But you were just saying before it was time to set up that it's not likely to happen in the atmosphere where death row is now.
No,
it's not like a cell block.
No, this where we're at right now, it's called 12 Building.
Yeah.
And 12 Building is not set up for group recreation. It's set up solely for a solitary confinement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no in and out. You know, you cannot just open your door and come out. An officer actually has to be there to press a button, kind of like a doorbell, press the button, and the other officer has to switch the
It
takes two. So unless you're outside, then you can't open another person's door. And that's a security measure, so nobody can open a door and jump out and, you know.
Yeah, well, that's why death row was moved to where it was, is to give it additional security.
I mean, it's changed a lot since I've been here.
There's a lot of talk about the damage done by solitary confinement conditions. Got any comment on that?
Oh, yeah, man. I've seen it. I've seen guys come in, you know, as healthy as can be mentally. And a few years down the road, you start hearing, wow, what's up with this guy? You start tripping a little bit, you know? Next thing you know, he's out there, and there's no coming back.
Jose Villegas, we're about to wipe this up. Why don't you look in that camera and tell him what you want him to know?
Well, you know, basically, I just wanted to come out here and say that, you know, should I be executed, you know, I just want people to know that, you know, not everybody that's back here is a bad person. People make bad decisions, and unfortunately they lead to where you are now, you know. And people that are back here in death row are not monsters. We're not your typical you know, murderers, I guess you would call them. But, and we got families, we got friends, we got, you know, kids and stuff like that. And going back to the whole changing, you know, people do change. And I think everyone is deserving of a second chance. Unfortunately, with the whole system, the death penalty, it doesn't allow you for a second chance, especially in Texas. Courts are not trying to hear what you want to say, and they pretty much just shut you down from the get-go. But, you know, I've lived long enough to know better. I've had enough life experience, and, you know, should it happen, it'll happen.
Thank you for the interview.
Thank you.
A letter from Jose Viejas, and he said the only thing he really didn't like about the interview, he enjoyed the interview and enjoyed my company, but the only thing he didn't like was it didn't talk enough about his kids and that he loved his kids. And I promised him if we played this interview, I would tell his kids, because they will see this, that your dad loved you and wishes you a good life.
I just got word from Elizabeth that the Supreme Court denied the stay of execution.
So the process has begun. Mr. Villegas, you heard from him just before he died. Next thing is to start the needle. To Elizabeth, does hearing the interview give you any reflections on the punishment phase? I mean, Elizabeth, Susan, does the hearing the interview give you any reflections on the punishment phase of this trial?
Well, what I had mentioned earlier about possible inhalant use affecting his brain, and he seemed to be very cogent and had an intelligent conversation with you, so that doesn't seem to be the case.
Oh, yeah, was I that other guy? Was I the guy that sounded so much like a convict on the interview? I'm not sure that...
Well, but you had an intelligent conversation with Mr. V.A. House.
He was able to pick up and finish some of my sentences.
Yes, that is true, and... I mean, he spoke very well. He had no trouble conversing with you, and he sounded, you know, fairly intelligent. Mm-hmm. So the inhalant use, okay, that was a possible idea, but doesn't seem to apply here.
We want to thank Elizabeth Stein for staying on it and coming back with a current report on what is going on at the Supreme Court. I suspect the witnesses are crossing the road now, and I suspect they will go on in, and we will... the next thing we'll know is that they'll be coming out. But we will probably be off the air. Okay, we have someone on the line. Pat? Pat, is that you?
Yes, the witnesses are just now coming across. It looks like the media. I don't see anybody that could be a family member, unfortunately. But it's just one group of witnesses.
One group of witnesses. That would just be the media, then, in that case.
Yeah, they're all have badges on, and they're all in suits, so...
Pat, would you tell folks how they can get in touch with your organization?
We are on Facebook under the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. We're an open group. You can ask to be friended, and it's the one with the gavel. And you can also go to abolitionmovement.org and get a hold of our webpage.
And
join our webpage, and you can keep up with the latest news.
And that's the abolitionmovement.org?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And you frequently write death row inmates. You have an organizational practice of sending people birthday cards.
Yes, we send birthday cards out. We send a newsletter out every month. And, of course, we have quite a few members that are coming up and visiting. We also visit the death row prisoners in Harris County, and I urge everyone in Houston, you do not have to be on a visiting list. We have 9 death row prisoners in Harris County. Get a hold of me, get a hold of any of us, and I will give you a list.
And some of them are still there, and some of them are back there from...
Yes, they're all on bench warrants, and a couple of them have been there over 2 years waiting for new trials, Randy Greer being one of them, Billy Mason, Guy Alexander, Marlon Nelson, Demetrius Smith has a hearing coming up at the end of this month.
Pat, I'll encourage folks to come to one of your meetings after finding you on the webpage.
Yes, we have a meeting the first Tuesday of every month at 7:00 at night at the Shape Center.
Thank you, ma'am.
You're welcome. Are you going to call me back when the witnesses come out?
Well, I suspect we'll be off the air because that's the way the clock works.
Well, before we go off the air, once again, I want to tell the guys on the road, we think about you. We're out here. We have your back, so don't give up hope. There are people out here all over the world thinking about you.
Thank you, ma'am.
You're welcome, sir. Bye-bye.
Okay, Jack Lee.
All right. I wanted to talk about, follow up on what Michael talked about. The
Michael Gillespie. I remember him.
You know, on ineffective counsel and direct appeal. But you don't really ever see ineffective counsel on direct appeal. Why you never see ineffective counsel on direct appeal? Well, the reason is that you've got 30 days to do your appeal, but the record's not ready. Your trial record's not ready for 15 to 30 days after the trial. So there's really no way for the appellate attorney to review the case and figure out whether to make an ineffective counsel argument or not. You need the testimony of the attorney because it's real hard to know what actually happened. And the appellate attorney, unless he already knows that he's going to be appealing it, he's not going to sit through the capital murder trial. So really, you need the trial record in order to figure out what to appeal. And frankly, as a practical matter, there's another reason why you never have a direct appeal. If you're not really ready for a direct, and you go ahead and you file a direct appeal, well, afterwards, you know, if you screw up the direct appeal at the next appellate level, they just say, well, you didn't bring it up on direct appeal, so you brought up ineffective counsel already on direct appeal, so they just reject your argument as a new argument.
Oh.
So there are multiple reasons why. But
are there cases that are tried to actually get better results on appeal?
I don't know. I mean, I can imagine, you know, if an attorney just decided an attorney on a capital offense just decided to sleep through the entire trial, then
Jim,
maybe,
would that be a strategy?
But that doesn't make any sense.
Well, let me tell you how crazy it is. First off, the law is really, really tough. The law has, there's a real strong presumption that anything the lawyer does in trial is trial strategy. And if he can come up with some explanation for trial strategy, then they're going to affirm the case and say the lawyer was not ineffective. For example, if there's nothing in the record showing what the lawyer's trial strategy is, the court will assume that he's working well. For example, Joe Cannon slept through part of a capital murder trial. And what happened, since they didn't have Joe Cannon's testimony in the record while he was sleeping, when it went up on appeal, Mike McCormick, who was the chief judge of the Court of Criminal Appeals, said that was trial strategy. Oh. He was trying to get sympathy from the jury. That's how far they've gone.
That's how far
with
this
stupid trial strategy concept. The Fifth Circuit reversed the case.
Okay.
But that's how far they go, because they'll go to extremes, and that's just nuts to say that a lawyer slept.
McCormick actually said that.
Actually wrote it.
In the opinion.
In opinion, Lay.
Okay.
And so what happened, there's that real strong presumption the defendant has got to rebut to show it's not trial strategy, and that's why it's critical to have the lawyer's testimony in the record so they can evaluate trial strategy. So,
as you listen to this, Jose Villegas is being killed. He witnesses across the road. They've had time to settle in their chairs. The chemicals have started down the vein injection tubes to his body. And he will die. We don't know much about the drug they're giving him to him because it's kind of a secret, and this is only the third time it's been used. Jack, does that complete your picture?
Well, the only other issue that I wanted to talk about was the Strickland test for ineffective counsel. It's a real, real tough mountain to climb for an appellate attorney to overcome. First, you have to show that the level of defense at trial was so below standard as to be considered negligent, meaning there was a duty and that and the defense attorney failed that duty. It's a real high bar. No matter what happens at trial, there's always the assumption, as Jim was saying, there's always the assumption that what the defense attorney did was part of their trial strategy. The really tough mountain is the but-for test. But for the defense attorney's mistakes, but for the defense attorney's actions. If he had done something else or not done something else that, by the way, was negligent, the result would have been different. If it's so, really, minutia, little things are just not going to
make it great.
And so it has to be effectively a big issue, and a big issue that actually was significant. And it's very hard to do.
Let's get Larry in here while Jim's talking.
Okay. A case in Oklahoma on a check-kiting case took the prosecutors 2 years to put it together, and they gave the lawyer like 2 months to prepare. Never tried a case before.
Yeah, okay.
Argued ineffectiveness, the result would have been different anyway. Would not have been different. They hired every lawyer in the world, and they affirmed the case that it was not ineffective.
Okay, surprise. Larry, what's your piece of the puzzle?
Well, one of the more interesting things about this case, Ray, is that today's April the 16th. 8 days ago, on April the 8th, Villegas' writ lawyers filed a subsequent writ. Meaning, writ's been filed before, filed a subsequent writ, raising for the first time the issue of mental retardation. And that was pretty summarily dismissed. That raises...
It would have been dismissed if they'd heard this interview.
It would have been dismissed, you're saying?
Yeah, if they'd heard this... Well, it was, but...
It was dismissed, but you're saying that the interview to you suggests that...
I'm talking to a cogent person who's following the conversation.
And so Jim and I were talking about the issues of ethics and professional responsibility. Lawyers... breach an ethical responsibility if you file frivolous
appeals
or frivolous writs. If you lawyers are officers of the court, and so you can't take actions for solely for the purpose of unreasonable delay. I'm not saying this lawyer is doing that, but I was sort of sharing with Jim that, you know, sometimes lawyers, our responsibilities, we get a little bit too involved in trying to accomplish an end, no matter what the means might be. But the issue of it's an uphill battle to file a subsequent writ to begin with, and bringing up the issue of mental retardation, or as they're calling it now, intellectual disability,
mm-hmm.
Was sort of a non-starter to begin with. In that the witnesses at trial had talked about, the same witnesses at trial, had discussed the fact that Jose was really a pretty smart kid. He got a GED, passed the test the first time, had had several jobs. The Atkins, Briseño factors on Atkins
weren't there.
Were just not there. They just did not seem to be there. And it raises some questions as to whether the lawyer who filed the writ, well, he has to. Everything is if he filed the writ in good faith, thinking that there was any possibility. But Jim was sort of chuckled about. I told a story a minute ago about a captain of industry who wanted an answer to a particular question, and he called three of his most trusted advisors to answer the question. Called his accountant,
yeah.
his economist, and his lawyer. And the question was, what is the sum of 4 + 2? And the accountant just said, it's 6. Well, the economist, hearing the question, says, well, I need to conduct a study. And it takes about maybe $25,000 in analysis. And 3 months later, he comes back and says, I can tell you with a 94% degree of certainty that it's somewhere between 5 and 7.
Okay.
Then he asks the lawyer. And the lawyer says, well, just a minute. Lawyer goes up and closes the door. And then he closes the drapes. And then he dims the lights. And then he checks the phone and the lamps to make sure there are no bugs. The lawyer comes over to him and whispers in his ear, what do you want it to be? Unfortunately, now, I don't want to knock the profession too much. But
well, Larry, one of my most cliche and off-used statements is that one of the greatest blessings of my life is that I am not a lawyer.
Maybe the law profession agrees
Well, lawyers, you know, the thing about it is, in a municipal court, when I'm dealing
they
with
might
that,
agree with you.
When I'm dealing with that chicken stuff case in municipal court, I can get more on the record than you can because I'm not an officer of the court.
That is true.
On more than one occasion, I have reminded Judge Bream of Municipal Court Number 4, Judge Bream, I think you've got to hear what I've got to say. There's no jury in this room. And if I've got to say it, you got to hear it. You can decide whether it's worth hearing or not later, but you got to hear it. And that'll get it all on the record, which sets it up for Mike Maness to take to civil court later. So,
well, Mike's dead. Like, I hate
know,
to tell you,
I know that, you, but that. But Mike and I work together like champs.
I know.
But even if the writ lawyer had been successful in fighting the uphill battle, the best he could have hoped for would have been a delay.
An hour.
Well, the
basically,
delay
that's
to
what happened.
Delay, it would have been the, well, he was not successful, yeah. but the real, if he had been successful in having the writ heard, granted, then the delay would have been to investigate the issue of mental retardation. And I'm not sure that how well that would have gone, but the court pretty summarily dismissed the argument that the burden had been met to hear a subsequent writ. Not in this case, and particularly on the issue of mental retardation when there was so much evidence to the contrary. And, you know, as Michael mentioned earlier, Mike Gillespie and I were talking, listening to the interview. If anyone from the Supreme Court were listening to that, that would have been, you know, even further evidence.
Well, they're kind of giving me the nudge, so it's time for me to muster out. I want to say that I actually met Jose Villegas. I liked Jose Villegas. I do not enjoy doing radio shows where Jose Villegas and my other friends that I've interviewed have died, but that happens a lot around here. My name is Ray Hill. I'm the host of Execution Watch. Elizabeth Stein is our executive producer, and she's responsible for the way this show works, and she makes that happen very well. I want to thank Jose Villegas for being our interview tonight. Our legal team with Jim Skelton, Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee did their usual wonderful job without a lot to work with. Pat Hartwell, we want to thank her for being in Huntsville and keeping us informed. Dave Atwood, we want to thank you for being in Houston and keeping us informed. Our next scheduled execution, I've got the wrong name on this paper, but there will be another execution in a couple of weeks. The one we're all dreading happening is Campbell. Robert Campbell's execution is the next one scheduled. Stay tuned for that when it happens. And then, of course, following him is the Robert Pruitt execution, which has us all concerned. Otis McClay is filmed tonight's broadcast and is our web guide wizard. Mark Pertle puts the videos together and makes all this happen. And the voice you hear in the background is Victoria Panetti, and you can reach her through She Monster International. My name is Ray Hill. Thank you for listening to Execution Watch.